it seems like it escalated. It made matters worse. It just got worse and worse. And I want to show you how Jesus handled the leaders that didn't like him. In the 19th chapter of the book of Luke, it tells that, and he came into the temple and began to cast them out them that bought, I did right, and he came into, that's why I read it, because I can't remember it. And he went into the temple and began to cast out them that sold therein and them that bought, saying, it is written, my house is the house of prayer, and ye have made it a den of thieves. And he taught daily in the temple, and the chief priests and the scribes and the chief of the people sought to destroy him. And they could not find what they might do, for all the people were very attentive to hear him. And it says that when he came into the temple on this certain day, and understand, he came into Jerusalem on the days leading up to the Passover. And he began to cast out those that bought and sold. Understand that the temple area consisted of an outer courtyard. And it was described as being filled with people that bought and sold therein. These were people that had booths set up with livestock in them. If you were a devout Jew and coming to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover, and you were coming from a distant country, you would not bring your livestock with you. You would come to the temple, and there would be people there that you could buy whatever was your desire to sacrifice. They would sell bulls and calves and so forth and lambs. These were for out-of-towners. And there were tables of money changers. If you were a resident of Greece or Rome or some other country, and you came to Jerusalem for the Passover, you would do just as if you went to Mexico, and you would, one of the first things you'd do, you'd probably go to the bank and convert some of your currency from dollars over to pesos. Same way here, they had money changers that to allow these people from Greece and Rome and so forth to come and convert their money into the Jewish shekels that they could pay their temple dues with. At a typical Passover in Jesus' time, there would be between 300,000 and 400,000 people in the town. And Jesus saw that the temple leaders and the town leaders had allowed the temple area to become a marketplace. And instead of people coming to worship and coming into this magnificent temple that Solomon had built, this glorious, to read the description of the temple is awe-inspiring, even today. Magnificent place, and instead of these people coming in and rejoicing of the magnificence of God's house and being in awe of being in the presence of God, instead of being that way, all they could hear was this market owner saying, hey, buy my stuff, don't buy his, I'm cheaper, I'll give you a better deal. The temple had become like the rest of the world, and is a big flea market. And we read in other gospels where Jesus made a scourge or a whip out of some cords, and he drove them out of the temple and the sheep, and he poured out the money changers' money, and he turned over the tables, and he told them, he says, you turned this, what is supposed to be a house of prayer, you've turned it into a den of thieves. And then after he had run everybody out, he brought the temple back to what it's supposed to do. He said he taught in it daily. He returned to preaching the gospel. And what happened when he done that? The chief priests and the scribes and the chief of the people sought to destroy him. Then in the 20th chapter, said, while Jesus was preaching, said, those that were trying to destroy him, these chief priests and chiefs of the people, they butted into his preaching. And in front of all the crowd, it kind of put him on the spot. He says, tell us, by what authority dost thou these things? Who give you the authority to do this? Now, that's not an unreasonable question in normal times, but like today, before someone is allowed to preach in any church, the person that is desiring to speak has to go before some established body. Some people, you have to have a degree, some you have to graduate from here, or reapproved by somebody or a group. That's a standard procedure so that it protects the people from being subjected to false teachings. But what they were doing in front of the people went beyond preaching. They asked, who give you the authority to come in here and drive these people out and to overturn these tables? Now, think just a moment. To publicly challenge someone's authority to speak is to sow seeds of doubt in people's minds as to whether he's even qualified to speak. If we were to have a guest preacher here, and halfway through his discourse, I stood up and say, wait a minute, who give you the authority to speak here? Regardless of whether he had said anything bad or not, it would plant a seed of doubt into what he was saying. It would make you question, what did old Brother Gleason see that I haven't seen? I need to listen to him just a little bit closer. And the purpose of the chief priest was to make people doubt what Jesus was saying, and they were trying to destroy him and the message he was preaching. And Jesus knew what they were trying to do, and he answered them, and he asked them about the baptism of John, of whose authority was that. And then he told them the parable, and I won't go into the parable much, but I want you to understand that the parable he told them, and I know you're familiar with it, is about the landowner that had a vineyard. And he had to leave the vineyard and go out of town, and he had a man, a vine dresser, a husbandman that would look after the vineyard in his absence. And as he went out of town, and he eventually sent a servant back to get some of the fruit from the vineyard. And the husbandman, the one that was looking after his vineyard, he didn't like that. So he abused and beat the servant that come back and sent him away. And then the owner sent another servant, and he received the same treatment. The vineyard dresser beat him and sent him away. And he done that the third time. And the fourth time, the owner of the vineyard said, surely if I send my beloved son, he will be received better and he will be able to receive the fruit of the vine. But when the beloved son of the owner of the vineyard arrived back, the vine dresser said, this is his son, this is the heir. If we kill him, we can take control of the vineyard. So they killed him. The owner's vengeance was poured out on the vine dressers. And through time, that's how Israel ended up as in exile to Babylon. But the leaders of Israel were being the vine dressers, the husbandmen of God's vineyard. They were afraid of Jesus. They were trying to destroy him. They were leading people away from the owner of the vineyard. But I want you to notice the owner of the vineyard, his wrath in this parable was against the vine dressers, those in charge of the vineyard. These are the leaders, whether it was the chief priest or the chief of the people or the scribes or the preachers or the city councils or ACLU or the federal government or the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. It was to those that determine who you can pray to, who that tell those in the vineyards that you're not allowed to do this anymore. That's where his wrath was directed to. And this parable has a lot of good lessons in it. But what I want you to see is that Jesus is instructing these people about the danger of their leaders, that their eyes should be open to what the leaders were doing. Now, why does Jesus tell the people about this? It's to show them that They are God's covenant people, and they have their own responsibility before God, and they are never to let their ideas and their thoughts about God be determined by public policy. They have a special bond of His ownership of them to consider, and no one can take that away by law or by decision being handed down. Jesus reassures them that the Lord of the vineyard will come in due time and take vengeance on the leaders of the vineyard. Now this was a time of great unrest. It was a power struggle. The leaders didn't like what was being preached. It didn't fit into their plans. And it seems the forces of hell were out to destroy this message of the Son of God sent to His vineyard. And in fact, in a few days, the vine dressers would cast out this beloved Son that had come to Jerusalem, and they'd hang Him on a cross and crucify Him. But Jesus is telling them to not worry. This is not a problem of yours, because they would never conquer the vineyard. It would never be theirs, no matter how much the leaders try. He tells the people to remember David's words, and he quotes part of the 118th Psalm. He said he looked at them, or he beheld them, and he said, "What is this then that is written? The stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner." Now, they didn't like that. And then he said, "And the chief priests and the scribes, the same hour, sought to lay hands on Him. And they feared the people, for they perceived that He had spoken this parable against them." They were offended, and they tried to grab a hold of Him. They were afraid that those that were following Jesus, instead of listening to what they were saying, And Jesus is telling them, and He says, I'm quoting this to show you that history is repeating itself. Their leaders are doing the same thing as old King Saul did years ago, just as Saul rejected the stone of God's choosing. So your leaders are doing the same thing. History is repeating itself. And Jesus said, this is the fulfillment of the prophecy of David, that the builders have rejected the stone that I chose. In the 118th Psalm, he talks about that. Now, I like this. The 118th Psalm is one of my favorites. It shows confidence that David had in God and His promises. And any time you start to doubt, any time you feel like God doesn't have your best interest at heart, that you feel like God has gone and left you, and you're fighting your battles alone, you need to read this. And understand that David was running for his life. Saul wanted to kill him. And he was hiding in caves. And he had not much of a rosy outlook. And he says, in the fifth verse, he says, "I called upon the Lord in distress. The Lord answered me and set me in a large place." Understand that this is David's darkest hours. His sword and shield are gone. He's trapped in a cave. He's surrounded. And he said, "The Lord put me in a large place." Large place. Not talking about this is a large church. It is the Hebrew word is merkav. It means a freedom, a lack of barriers. It's like going from being in a closet, and somebody sets you out in the middle of the field where you can see no fence, no woods, no nothing. All you see is a wide open space. And he says, "God has set me in this place regardless of where I am. I'm surrounded by my enemies." He says, "All nations compass me about, but in the name of the Lord will I destroy thee." Look at the confidence he has. Things didn't look very good for him. He says, "Thou hast thus sore me that I might fall. But the Lord helped me, and the Lord is my strength, my song, and has become my salvation." God had promised David he would be king, and it sure didn't look like it now, but David was sure that God would keep his word, and he'd become king, even though he was surrounded by the enemy. And now God had put him in a large place, and through the freedom of his mind, he was allowed to see one of the most beautiful prophecies that we have, that the hand of God still rules, that regardless of what laws are passed or what decisions are handed down, that God still rules and his plan will not falter. He says, I will praise thee, for thou hast hurt me and art become my salvation. The stone which the builders refused has become the head of the stone of the corner. And we can take a whole lot of comfort in that today. You see an example of a building. You take a landowner, and he has the perfect spot. He wants a house sitting right here, and he wants the cornerstone to be this beautiful rock that he's picked out himself. He wants that rock to be the cornerstone. And he calls a building contractor, and the building contractor, and I'm not pointing any fingers at you, brother, but the building contractor comes, and after the owner leaves and has told him he wants the house built upon this cornerstone, building contractor says he doesn't know what he's talking about. I'd rather have it over here. I'm going to reject the stone of the owner had picked out. I'm going to build the house over here. Well, it ended up that the stone that the builder had picked out was the one that the building was built upon. The one that the contractor rejected ended up being the chief cornerstone. That's what he's talking about. It was built on the one that the contractor had rejected. And what David was seeing, that God had anointed him to be king, or the main stone for the foundation of the kingdom of Israel. But King Saul had rejected David. But in God's time, the stone which the builders rejected, which the Jews and the chief priests and the leaders of the country had rejected, had now become the chief cornerstone, and David was crowned king of Israel in due time, in spite of Saul's attempt. Now, why did Jesus quote this in front of those people that tried to destroy him in the temple? Why was he quoting 118? He said he wanted to cause the people to realize that if you're called on to dress vines in God's vineyard, you need to see that you're tending the vines in according to what the owner has said, and not the husband. You don't have to please him. You need to please the owner. Now, in today's society, we can't say anything about abortion. We can't say anything about sexual perverts. We can't say that the God of the Muslims is a faith. We can't say anything like that. Our leaders will seek to lay hands on you because we passed laws to do that, and they'll throw you in jail. So we have to be careful. And what that amounts to, we are being conditioned to fear to serve God. Now, what difference does that make? Surely our God understands the conditions we're in. He understands that it's risky to speak out. We're getting in trouble, and I don't believe my God wants us to offend anybody. I believe we're all children of God. It is because of his love. We've all been taught that. We all believe that. We're even told that we ought to behold this precious love that has created this bond. But I want you to see who is this God that loved us enough that would send his son to die for us. In the book of John, he talks about that love. In the fourth chapter, the seventh verse, he says, "Beloved, let us love one another. We know this by heart. Let us love one another, for love is of God. Everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. But he that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love." He talks about our love and God's love. He says, let us love one another. That is a verb. In Greek, that verb is pronounced agapaio. It is meant to have, for us to have respect. It is to have dignity for someone, to honor someone, to have an emotion for someone. To agapaio is to show a respect to someone. I'm as bad as anybody else. I say I love old cars. I love lemon pie. I love butter pecan ice cream. No, I like that. To love someone is an action verb, is to show emotions of affection to someone. That is agapao. In the next verse, he said, "He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love." Same word in the English translation. In the Greek, it's not agapao. This is a noun. It's agape. This is a identification of God. It is describing who God is. It's a in the deepest sense of the word. I can no more describe the agape love of God as being an identifying quality of Him. I can no more describe that than I can describe the goodness of God or the righteousness of God or the mercy of God. I cannot put that in words. And same way, God's love, agape, is beyond description. It is a quality of God. It's an identifying prospect of God. And so the question comes about that it's hard for us to think about God in any other way except that God is love and He's mercy and He's grace. But our main connection with God is that He is a God of love. But the question is that all there is to God? The second command is that He gave to the people at Sinai. He says, "Thou shalt have no other God before me, and you should not bow down to any graven images." And the reason He said that is He says, "I, the Lord, am a jealous God." So He is a God of love, He is a God of mercy, and He is a jealous God. Remember when Aaron made the golden calf at Sinai, the Lord said, "My name, my character, my nature, what I am to be known as is jealous." This is the part of God's true identity. We need to understand that the God we bow down to is a God of love. He is a God of jealous. And He said, "Well, wait a minute, for God to be jealous, that's terrible. That's one of the seven deadly sins." There's no such thing as the seven deadly sins. That's something Catholics made up. All sins are deadly. And he said, "Well, that's one of the you got pride and greed and envy and lust and wrath and gluttony and sloth, but that's one of them. But what we call jealousy is really envy. If I want what you've got a new car, I'm not jealous of you. I'm envious of you. We call it jealousy, but it's envy. I want what you've got. I'm not satisfied with what I have." And we have to be very, very careful, because envy is a terrible monster. It's powerful and it's destructive. And it creates anger and hatred. And it destroys friendship. And it's this awful thing to have. But that's not being jealous. And we can't put that on God. What jealousy is, jealousy is different. Jealousy in the Greek is kana. It means not allowing any rival. To have jealousy is to rightly avenge any departure from you. It's a noble act. It's not a deadly sin. It's a noble act. Consider a marriage. If a stranger comes into your life and finds their place in the heart of your spouse, then you have every right to be jealous. That is a noble act. If you did not get jealous, I would question your love for your spouse. People say, "I don't get jealous, I trust my spouse." It has absolutely nothing to do with trust. Jealous is being a reaction to love, not trust. We get that seriously wrong. If my wife and I were out walking around and a lady passed by and I acted inappropriate, don't care how much she trusts me, she should be jealous. If she didn't get jealous, I would come back with, "What's the matter? Don't you love me anymore?" It is a reaction to love. So when we say that God is jealous, I want you to understand that it is a reaction of His love to you. He knows He can't trust us. But when He is jealous, It is a reaction of his love for his people. He has bound himself to a peculiar people by love. And his jealousy is realized when that people turns from him and starts to serve other gods. Then God gets jealous. God has promised to redeem the people of his love and so demands their absolute loyalty. We read about Ezekiel when Israel was taken into captivity in Chaldea. And Ezekiel was sent with these captives to Chaldea to write to these people and to warn them about false prophets and changing what God had commanded. And he writes, he's talking to the exiles. He's talking about Jerusalem, where they were captured in. But he's talking to the people out of Jerusalem that are now in Chaldea. And he's talking about Jerusalem. He says, Jerusalem has rebelled, or they have refused against my judgment. They have made a mockery of his laws. They've changed what used to be bad into what was good. They've refused to walk in obedience. They have followed the corruption of their leaders. This was a spiritual adultery on Israel's part. God loves his children so deeply, and he is so very possessive of them, and Israel has turned away from her jealous lover. And God was jealous with them. And he says in the 13th chapter, and they shall know that I am the Lord, have spoken it in my zeal. This zeal is an enthusiastic devotion. He said, this is something that is very important to me. He said, they shall know this when I pour out my fury on them. God is telling the exiles, he said, I'm going to bring judgment on the people in Jerusalem. This was the city of God's choosing. David had captured it to make it the capital of his kingdom, and Solomon had built this glorious temple in it, and the Ark of the Covenant was there, and the people, even though they were in captives, they knew that God had promised to always be with them. They were God's people. And they knew God wasn't going to destroy his wonderful temple. He wasn't going to destroy David's city. They certainly weren't going to be destroyed. They knew that they could be safe, and it didn't make any difference. They could just go along with society in Chaldea. They could do what it was. They could make a mockery of his law, and God would understand. But maybe not. He says in verse 8, he says, behold, I am against thee. This is God talking to him. He said, I am against thee. I will execute judgment in the midst of thee. He said, I'm not with you anymore. I will not hear your prayers anymore. Realize we don't want to hear this. We don't like this. We want to think of God as a God of mercy, and he'll put up with anything we do. Look what all we've gotten by with so far. We can push him a little bit. It's just like a young child. I'll push my daddy. If I can get by with this, maybe I can get a little more the next day. And that's what we do with God. We think, well, we can break this law, we can stretch this, and he didn't do nothing to us today, so let's try this tomorrow. And that's what they were saying. Look what we've done so far. He will tolerate whatever we do because he loves us. You remember back in Leviticus, when God first claimed Israel to be his people, he told them, he said, if my people turn their back on me, if they serve other gods, said he would pour out the covenant curses on them. He would destroy them. He says, don't take my covenant for granted. And they ignored his instructions, and that's why they had to feel the jealousy of him. He said, I'm against thee. And that's scary to me. God's jealousy was provoked enough that he would pour out his judgments on his people. That's a serious thought. And I've often wondered why God tolerates us. Why does he put up with us? And what's the tipping point? Understand that this didn't happen overnight. His jealousy didn't flare up with the straw that broke the camel's back. You remember where Ezekiel had to lay on his left side for 390 days and his right side for 40 days is one day for each year that they'd been disobedient, that they'd followed other gods. Realize that this destruction was about the city of Jerusalem. This jealousy means the end of believers. that's still in Jerusalem. But the exiles were spared the destruction. They were being told that, and it's even that Jesus himself would be born from their midst, but their beloved city, their beloved temple would be destroyed. Now, why were they told that? Why were they told about God's fury from Jerusalem? So God could teach them who he was, that their God was jealous, and they should serve him with a zeal, a greater devotion, lest they perish like the leaders did. They were an example to them. Now, it's obvious that this country has been blessed by God. We need to understand that his love for us is so deep, is so intense, that any turning away, any changing of his laws, any rejecting of his love provokes a deep and a fearful jealousy. He demands our perfect obedience to the statutes of the covenant, and he insists that we serve him perfectly with absolute loyalty. There is no provisions in there to change his laws to keep from offending people. But this, what I'm trying to say, is not about civil disobedience. He says you can take comfort. It's regardless of what the world preaches. It's regardless of how many lawsuits are put out there. It's regardless of how much ridicule that you might receive from your neighbors or those in school. It's regardless of how polluted the world becomes. No matter how hard public opinion tries to convince you that it doesn't make any difference what rock you stand on or how much you upgrade your building, God doesn't care because he is a God of love. That's not the problem. They're trying to destroy the foundation. But that's not the problem, because they'll never succeed. It will be built upon the Christ's rock. But your concern is what you need to worry about. Whenever you hear these reports that God declares that he is a very jealous about Jesus being your rock, he is jealous not from what you hear, not from what other people try to convince you. It is that you follow him, that you build on the rock, and you stand on the rock of Jesus Christ. That's his message to you, is don't be swayed regardless of what you see coming down in the news. This is about his people, and he loves you so much that he's jealous, and he's warned you about it. May God bless you, is my prayer. I hope that something might be said that be of a benefit to you, to help us to worship God in his glory. Now the doors of church are open for reception of members. Having announcements, we'll make them afterwards. Brother Keith, you have a song we sing. I invite you all to come back again next month. I will be away next month. Elder Gene Hogan has agreed to fill in my place. I appreciate you give him the same attention and understanding you do me. But Keith, you have a song to sing.
320, first three and the last.
320.
On Jordan's stormy banks I stand and cast a wistful eye to Canaan's fair and happy land, where my possessions lie. Together let us sweetly live, together let us die, and each a starry crown receive in that bright world on high. Oh, the transporting rapture sing that rises to my side, sweet fields of radiant living green and rivers of delight. Together let us sweetly live, together let us die, and each a sorry cry.
Thank you.